Well, good morning, everybody. How many are here today who were not here last night? If you just give me a show of hands, okay? What I'd like to do to begin, if you don't mind, is to take you on a little meditation. We will be doing a piece of work this morning, what I call writing your first step. Now, you don't have to write it all this morning, but I at least want to take you through a model of the way I think it can be done in terms of codependency. So I'll be asking you to reflect a lot on your own life and your own life experience, a lot of private kind of work this morning. This afternoon, we may do a little more sharing. But if you would just get real comfortable for right now, remember when you meditate to be comfortable. First time I learned meditation, I meditated on my nose itching for the entire time. So if your nose itches, scratch it and just be as comfortable as you can. And I recommend that you close your eyes. If you don't feel comfortable with that, don't do that, or you can close them and peek occasionally. So if you just close your eyes right now and just for a couple of minutes, focus on your breathing. Just allow your mind to become full of breathing so that you're mindful of breathing. This basic life function that we do unconsciously most of the time. Just be aware of what happens in your chest, what happens in your body when you breathe. And if you like, you can be aware of the air as it comes in, what it feels like when it comes in, and the air as it goes out. Be aware of the difference, the contrast, as you breathe in and as you breathe out. As you focus on your breathing, just for now, there's no place you have to go. There's nothing you have to do. There's no face that you have to prepare to meet the faces. You can just be here now. Be here now. Be here now. Feel the pew on your back and your feet on the ground. Feel your hands. Touching your body or wherever they are. Hear the sounds, whatever sounds you can hear. Thank you. and feel your clothes on your body. Feel the air that touches your face. Just be in touch with yourself in the here and now. Just in touch with yourself. And as you breathe in and out, if you could begin to see like a white number 7 on a black curtain, or a black number 7 on a white curtain. And it's okay if you don't see it. You can just imagine yourself finger painting it. Or you can hear it in your mind's ear, 7, as you breathe out. Or you can do all 3 of those. Just focusing your attention now so you can get to that inner stillness. Inner quiet. And then the number 6. Seeing the number 6. Or finger painting it. Or hearing it as you breathe out. That mental image that you learned to make long ago when you were children. When you were children in school, the teacher put the numbers on the board. You had to make a mental image of every number. And you had to compare that mental image with every other number. You had to compare a 6 with a 5, and a 6 with a 4, and a 6 with a 3, and a 6 with a 2, and a 6 with a 1, and a 1 with a 2, and a 1 with a 3, and a 1 with a 4. And a 1 with a 1, and a 2 with a 1, and a 3 with a 1. And now you do all of that unconsciously. You never think about it. So your unconscious really knows so much more than your conscious mind. You can really trust your unconscious. You can trust your unconscious throughout this day to allow you to focus on the things you need to know for you. The things that are important for you, and not compare yourself with anyone else, because you're incomparable. And what's important for you may not be important for someone else. And there's no right or wrong in this work. It's what's important for you. And now see the number 5. Just allow yourself to relax, just to go into this inner peace. And the number 4, number 4, and the number 3, just allowing yourself to go to the place that's most appropriate for you. To take you into your own relaxation, your own inner calm and inner peace. And then the number 2, and the number 1. And now as you focus on the number 1, just begin to see it become a candle. So you're looking into the flame of that candle, that quiet, powerful energy of fire. The blue, orange, yellow, reddish flame. Just gaze into the center of that and let the center of that flame, the power that comes from its burning, but the stillness. Just let that take you to your own center, your own sense of integration. And that you can trust yourself. You can trust that what you focus on today will be what's important for you. And you can trust that even though you may not grasp it all or be able to retain it all, you'll retain what's important to you. And you can really trust this deep, profound sense of yourself. And now, for a minute of clock time, which is all the time in the world to the unconscious, just let your whole self integrate. Just let your whole self be in a dream of integration. Just for 1 minute of clock time. And do that now. Take that symbol of integration, whatever it is, the feeling or the words or the images or the colors that came to you, and just trust that your unconscious really knows. That you've forgotten all the new learnings in your life, all the times you did things you didn't know you could do, all the beginnings that were frightening to you that you got through and surprised yourself with. That you can really trust yourself. And that you have hope for yourself, or you wouldn't be here. And you have courage, and you're willing to risk. And you can love yourself and embrace yourself. And just staying in that center, and you can count on it, that this calm will stay with you all day. That you can trust this centeredness all day long. Now in your mind's eye or in your mind's ear, begin to see the candle flame turning into a one. The number one. And then the number two. And then the number three. And ever so slowly now, you're slowly coming back to your normal waking consciousness. The number four, knowing that you can retain this kind of inner centeredness and peace. And the number five. And the number six. And now very slowly with the number seven. As you see or finger paint it, just slowly, very slowly now, open your eyes and be fully present in this beautiful place, sound in mind and sound in body. One of the ways to describe codependency
is to say that it's exactly the opposite of what we just did. That it's to have no inner life. And that our life is characterized by a relinquishment to the outside. And last night I talked about dysfunctional families and how that happens to anyone in a dysfunctional family. Because every dysfunctional family, whether it's an alcoholic or chemical family, whether it's a rageaholic family, whether mother is hysterical and worries all the time and hyperventilates and drives everybody crazy, or whether mother's a hypochondriac and so you have to walk on eggs all the time, or daddy's a work addict and mama's his enabler, and there's tension in their relationship and you always are reacting and responding to that tension, or whether there's religious addiction in the family and you're always being measured by biblical verses or so that you can never have your feelings or be real. Whatever the dysfunction is, you're going to have to adapt to something on the outside. I can remember as a kid being two blocks from my house and saying to myself, well, I wonder what's going on in there. Is daddy home? If he's home, is he drinking? If he's drinking, what kind of shape is he in? If he isn't home, what kind of shape is mother in? Is she going to be raging? Could I bring a friend home? No. See, my whole life was an adaptation to the stress. And so I suggested to you last night, if you're a child of any dysfunctional family, violent families, sexually abusing families, a little girl who's being sexually abused doesn't ever want to go home. One of my clients told me she would stay outside as long as she could. Her brother was abusing her. Her life was one total misery. She wanted to die. She couldn't understand how anybody would ever want to live. Why anybody had any joy out of life. Why anybody was interested in things. Because her life was like being hunted. And so violence, you never know whether daddy's going to knock mother across the room or knock one of you across the room. One day you can do something and he's okay, the next day you do the same thing and he goes crazy. Or mama goes crazy. Do you see the stressor? And that a child is continually adapting, but the danger's on the outside. So my best definition of codependency is what I took from Artigi Gasset, the Spanish existentialist philosopher, where he characterizes human life as within oneselfness, instimismamiento, the Spanish word, within oneselfness, to have an inner self, an inner relationship with self. That's an identity. As opposed to alteration, he says, otheration. Other, the word O-T-H-E-R hyphen ation, A-T-I-O-N. That is that my life is totally relinquished to the outside, like an animal. Like an animal. Animals live totally on guard, looking for food, protecting their territory. They are other-aided, as opposed to healthy humans that are hopefully have a life within themselves. Codependency is otheration. Your whole life is determined by what's outside of you. Now, there are degrees of this. If you come from an alcoholic, violent, sexually abusing family, you're going to be far more damaged than somebody who may be from an alcoholic family where dad isn't a violent drunk, but it's just a stressor. If you come from a religiously addicted family or a workaholic family, that'll even be more crazy-making. Because how do you know, here's this good, holy mother. Or here's this father who's an elder in the community, he's an elder in the church, he's on the mayor's council. He makes thousands, millions of dollars. Or, boy, that's real crazy-making. And see, there's myths about families. Part of the delusion and denial is the myth. The myth. Every time I used to get upset about my grandfather for some reason, who was the only father figure I had, they would say, Well, your grandfather prayed the rosary when Stalin died. So I'd go to my room, you know, man. How can you get mad at somebody who prayed the rosary when Stalin died? And if I'd asked my mother about my dad, she said, well, everybody, your father's popular. Everybody in West Texas knows your dad. Except me. You know, everybody in town knew my dad except me. So you see, those are the myths that you're told to distract you from what's really happening. And that's called delusion and denial. And dysfunctional families are dominated by delusion and denial. Oh, I had a happy childhood. And listen, when I'm through today, some of you will get to a lot of feelings. You may get into a lot of pain. You'll go out of here, and by tomorrow you'll be saying, well, Bradshaw, you know, of course he had that screwed up family. Mine wasn't that bad. Because basically, what you have to do to leave these family systems is go through a grief process. Anybody that's going to grow up has got to leave home. And when you leave anything, you grieve. And I guarantee you, the first thing you will experience as you really begin to look at the way your family really was is shock, which is what everybody experiences in grief. You go, oh no, Harold didn't die, you're kidding. Oh no, my family really wasn't like that. As I shared last night about my own emotional incest and the issues of being set up as my mother's surrogate spouse as part of the family system. See, if a family doesn't have a daddy, a family's like a mobile. It tries to balance itself, so it needs somebody to be the husband. If there's no daddy there, one of the boys in the family will become the emotional husband. If daddy isn't making it with mama, and they're staying together in their relationship, but there's this big intimacy vacuum, nature abhors a vacuum. So daddy will pick up one of the daughters to be his little princess or to be his emotional confidant. And then the daughter will be used by the father for his emotional needs. How do you like to be used in a relationship, folks? But when you're a kid, you can't get that you're being used. That's what we call the setup. See, I was proud that I was my mother's favorite. My grandfather called me 4 times a week. Are you taking care of your poor mother? 9 years old. Yes, sir, I'm taking care of her. We were all taking care of her. And my mother's okay. My mother's a victim too. I'm not putting her down for this, but you gotta find out what really happened. How did this leg get crippled? How come it is that I'm 45 years old and I've still got all these problems? I still have relationship problems. And I've been through bunches of relationships, and I don't know what I feel, and I don't know how to express my feelings. And as soon as all the activity stops, I feel suicidal or depressed and lonely. Where's all that come from? It doesn't happen in healthy, warm, vibrant families when people are getting their needs met. So we've got to begin to look at what happened to us so we can deal with it in ourselves. The second level of grieving is denial. Shock, oh no, denial, then bargaining. Well, my family really wasn't that bad. Bargaining, 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 bargaining. Then anger. And then you start getting below the anger. See, because below the anger is the hurt and the pain. And I said last night, I quoted Carl Jung, who said, neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering. What we don't want to get to is that hurt and that pain. For me to really accept that I didn't have a father, that my father didn't love me. They said, well, your daddy really does love you. They constantly told me my daddy really loves me. See, Scott Peck defines love as the will to extend yourself for the sake of nurturing your own and another's spiritual growth. On that definition, my daddy didn't love me. Now, my daddy was surrogate spoused with his mother. He had been abandoned by his own father. I never saw my grandfather once in my life. So I'm not blaming my dad. This is not a blame game. This is a responsibility game. Try to find out what really happened to us and break through all this family system delusion and denial and all this mythology. For all my life, my dad's family was screwed up. My dad was the alcoholic. And my brother and I'd get drunk and we'd say we're going to go beat up dad or we were going to go get dad. And always it was mother we were taking care of, and her family was perfect. My grandfather prayed the rosary when Stalin died. My grandmother was in bed for 50 years, but of course she was sick. And then it dawned on me at 45 that three of her daughters were alcoholic and three had married alcoholics. Perfect family. Went to St. Vincent de Paul Church. I compared every family to them. They were probably sicker than my dad's family. But it's crazy making. It's much harder to get because they were all in roles all the time. They never showed any real feelings. It was always a pretend and be a nice woman and always guard your feelings. And this afternoon we're going to get into those roles, those family system roles, and the pretend and the act. That soul murders you. You lose your soul when you go into those acts. You're no longer you. And after 20 years of it, you don't even know who you are. You think you're the act. You can pass lie detectors. They say, is this who you are? Yes, sir, that's who I am. I had a therapist one time tell me, God, you must be lonely. I thought it was the craziest thing I'd ever heard. I went out of there vowing never to go back to him. I fired several therapists in my life anytime they told me things I didn't like. But it haunted me. I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And I realized that I was so into my act. I was so distracted all the time. I had energy and activity and work and stuff going all the time. I never had any time to know what I felt. See, and sometimes you've got to get to these quiet places. And you've got to go in there and get quiet so that you can know and catch up with yourself. So that you can know what you really feel. See, sometimes you gotta feel as bad as you really feel if you're ever gonna get well. You gotta feel as bad as you really feel. And if you stay distracted and all your stuff are obsessed on your alcoholic boyfriend, you're in your head sleuthing around trying to save him or trying to save your husband, trying to save your children. You're in your head all the time obsessing, ruminating, you don't ever have time to know what you feel. So a lot of times if we get a woman in treatment whose husband's an alcoholic or a man in treatment whose wife's an alcoholic, we try to keep, you know, and like the questions last night, how do I fix my husband? How do I fix my... See, that's codependency. It's like, what I gotta do is get in touch with me. If my mama could have ever been helped, if somebody could have said, Norma, wait a minute, what do you feel? Now tell me what you feel. And let her get how lonely she was. How terrible this non-intimate marriage was. And quit focusing on us or my daddy's drinking. Then you see what feelings do is they move you. You don't know what you feel, you don't have your energy, your fuel. And so why do we talk so much about getting into your feelings? Because it's precisely in these systems that are dysfunctional that you have to give up your feelings. You can no longer have your feelings. You have to adapt to survive. We'll really be working on that this afternoon, whatever role you got in. Like I was a hero in my family system. What feelings do you have to give up to be a hero? What feelings can't you have if you're going to be a hero? The heroes can't wimp around and be afraid. So one of the ways I've broken out of that is when my family, somebody in my family calls me, which they rarely do now, they say, well, how's it going? I say, well, not bad for an emotionally disturbed person. I'm not going to be the hero anymore. And because, you know, all my life I tried to take care of my little brother, and I was my dad's dad in AA. I brought my dad into AA. They used to call me a block off the old chip. And all my life I've been taking care of people. I went to be a priest so I could take care of the world. You know, it's like I got to stop doing that if I want to live and have my own reality. So you've got to go to this inner place. And the grief process is a hard process. We're not telling anyone that you have to leave your family or not have a relationship with your mom and dad. But you've got to get out of that family. And the way you do that is you grieve it. Because if you stay in the family, you go right back into the codependency. You go back into the roles that keep the thing together. See, dysfunctional families are characterized by frozenness and rigidity. Nobody can leave. If your family's dysfunctional and they're having the big get-together at Christmas and you say, well, look, I've got all these friends in Santa Fe and we have this wonderful community there and we network and we go up in the mountains and we meditate and we're all going to celebrate and we're going to all come together to create a consciousness threshold for world peace. And I'm really excited about it. You'll hear a silence on the other end of the line. And they say, well, okay. You know, your father's getting old and he may not be around for very long. And I too was, you know, I have high blood pressure now. And I may not be around next year. And so the classic feeling, if you're from a dysfunctional family, is guilt. See, that's the thin veneer. Terry Kellogg says this is the thin veneer of codependency, is guilt. What it means is you do not have a right to be a unique person. I went to Rice University. I went there for 4 years. After 2 master's degrees, I got first class honors in all the courses. I learned French and German, passed oral and written comprehensive. I taught the psychology of religion for 2 years and never got a doctorate. It took me 15 years to get what that was all about. And what it was about is my family system. That you can't be that powerful. You can't be a doctor coming out of my system. That's too hard for anyone in the system to handle. And I'm going to tell you, when you get onto this systemic stuff, Tommy Weisskopf started winning, won 6 golf tournaments in a row after his dad died. And when they'd interview him, Tom would say, God, I wish my dad was here to see this. See, why was it that he suddenly could start winning the golf tournaments after his father died? I'll bet you anything, and I don't know this for a fact, that that dad had a message to him, don't you ever be better than me. Don't you ever be better than me. And that, you know, you don't ever achieve more than I have in this family system. So the idea that I could, you know, a healthy family wants you to be happy and be with your community and working for world peace. If you had healthy people, they'd want you. They'd love you and affirm you and want you to have your individuality. And not be into their own narcissism and their own neediness. So you come home to take care of me so I'm not lonely. That's not about you that they want to see you when they're putting all that guilt on you. It's about them. It's about their neediness. The people I love, and thank God I've had the therapy I've had. My son's leaving me, and I've cried about it, and it's painful. He's 17. He holds a crucifix up when I come in the room. I think that's normal 17-year-old. I'll tell you in about 10 years. You know, and I'll say, John, how's it going? Fine. What happened to school today? Nothing. Did you have a good day? Yes. And then he's out of the room. And it's, see, I'm needy. And I said, you know, I gave him the money to go to Europe recently. I never was on an airplane until I was 21. Comes back from Europe. Well, how was it? How's Michelangelo? He's dead. You know, I paid $1,800 for this trip. By God, you're going to share with me. And I want some gratitude. See, that's not about this kid. He's trying to puberty. And that's real hard to do. This kid's trying to be an adolescent. He's trying to find an identity. He's trying to leave a very powerful father and have a life of his own. I need to get off of my own neediness. You get it that that's about me? That's not about him? He needs a father he can count on, who's not pouting every time he comes in the house. This child's trying to grow up and do the hardest transition in the life cycle, which is adolescence. And it's hardest on parents, too. I wouldn't let anybody have one till they had hung around some adolescents. If it was up to me, I'd have home ec courses you got to go hang around with adolescents before you start having babies. And really get what that's about and have them carry babies around and you can't put them in your locker. And just really get what it's about to be a parent, because I wouldn't let anybody do it under 30 if it was up to me. Any 15-year-old with a blood test can have a child. Not even with a blood test. Any 15-year-old can have a child. You need more training to be a telephone operator answer. You get more training than you do to be a mother or a daddy. So needy people find each other, and then they figure out after they get married and the in love is over, the romance is over. See, when we're courting, we don't let the other person know about our neediness. But as soon as you get married, then the unconscious contract of two needy people is, guess what, you're my mother. Guess what, you're my daddy. See, if you haven't worked through those source relationships. I was a wonderful charmer. When I came out of the seminary, I dated for about 5 years, and boy, I would just charm and send roses and flowers and gentle John. And then as this woman would start loving me, here would come all the rage from the setup with mother. And it would start with little things like, well, you're not going to wear your hair like that, are you? And then it would end with raging at her at a certain point. And see, the woman would always be just totally amazed at this gentle poet. You know, had this raving side to him. And see, I never got it that was about that I had never left my mother. That I was still bonded to her, I was still married to her. How can you love somebody else if you're still married to your mother? And I see this over and over again in males, because there's so few bonding. Fathers aren't in the home anymore. Boys can't bond with fathers in order to break the bonding with mothers. And as a boy is controlled by a mother and becomes her little man, then he's got a lot of rage about that. But it's unconscious, because you're set up not to be able to get mad at your mother, because you honor your parents, and at the second you express that, people are calling you ungrateful. And so you're set up. And so that anger gets acted out on every woman in my life. My wife used to say, wouldn't matter what I did, you're going to be angry. And until I divorced my mother, that was true. So these are real big problems, and two needy people come together, they're not going to be able to take care of each other, so guess what? At a certain point, they say, let's have a child. And the child, then, in dysfunctional families is set up to take care of the parents' emotional needs. People don't grasp it. We say it over and over again. You've been taking care of your parents' feelings. What that means is, whenever you had a feeling that they didn't like, they told you to stop having that feeling to please them. And do you get it that what we now understand about emotional life is that people need to be connected to their feelings? Why? You can't have your feelings if you numb out, cut them off, repress them. They don't go away. They're energy. So I couldn't have my anger as a child. Guess what? Every once in a while, I would lose it. What does that mean? You say, I lost my temper today. Where'd you lose it? You know, I don't know what came over me, people will say. God, I don't know what happened. Boy, did I lose it today. See, do you get it? You can't repress those feelings and not have them come out. Or they'll come out passive-aggressively, which is really bad. That's like licking a big St. Bernard dog and having a big St. Bernard dog licking you and having him peeing on you at the same time. That's passive aggressive. The anger will come out somewhere. The anger will come out somewhere. Okay? So this issue of getting in touch with our own feelings, all addictions are ways to manage feelings. All addictions are about shame-based broken relationships. And that's what happens in dysfunctional families. Anyone from a dysfunctional family is codependent. Anyone who's addicted is codependent. You're codependent first. Carl Menninger, in my AA talk, I used to talk about alcoholism as a disease of a disease. I was quoting Carl Menninger in his book, Man Against Himself. He said, an alcoholic is a man, woman, running into the sea to put out the fire, but drowning. It's a disease of a disease. You've got to stop the drinking because it's primary, progressive, pervasive, permanent, and terminal. But once you stop the drinking, and this is what Bobby Earle and I and others and why we're controversial, because we're going into these programs and saying, hey, it's not enough just to behavior modify this drinking. You got to deal with the core, the hole in your soul, the insatiable child that never gets enough, the compulsivity. That's the disease of the disease. And another word for that is codependency. Codependency is a set of adaptive behaviors to survive with. If you're codependent, you have been abandoned, including neglect, enmeshment, and abuse. See, I define abandonment as neglect, enmeshment, and abuse. Codependency is a symptom of abuse. Pure and simple. And so what happens is, and why this work is important, is that if you don't connect with what happened to you, you keep thinking it's about you. You keep thinking you need to control everything. That's just a quirk. That's just your own idiosyncratic personality quirks. You're hypervigilant. That's just your own idiosyncratic personality quirks. You have a lot of physical illnesses. You're dissociated. You don't have relationship. You're either an offender in the relationship or a victim in the relationship, or you have this victor-offender ambiguity. All of that is a response to the way you've been violated. It's a post-traumatic stress symptom. And you see, if we don't connect, this has been the major work of the people in Minnesota, people like Terry Kellogg, try to help us focus on what happened to us, how we were violated. And see, violence is violation. It's not just knocking your head off. If you saw your mother beaten, you were a victim of violence. If you were threatened by tonight your father's coming home, you're already a victim of violence, whether he ever spanks you or not. People yelling at you are violating you. People jerking you across the room, slapping you across the face, are violating you. Sexually abusing you, using you for their own needs, the very people that are supposed to be your caretakers. That's why sexual abuse has shock in it, the upper respiratory. It's so shocking to a person to have that happen to them. So do you understand that any of this kind of abuse, physical, emotional, intellectual, what do you know? Who gave you that stupid idea? Where'd you get an idea like that? Violation of your intellectual. And of course, this happens in schools too, and it happens in churches. So codependency is a cultural phenomenon. Why do we talk about 95% of people being codependent? And why is this movement spreading all over the country with people who 15 years ago would have never called themselves codependent? Would have never said, I really have a problem. Because our culture, our churches, our sex roles are perfect codependent roles. Our idea of marriage is a codependent thing. Listen to the kicker songs. Stand by your man. You know, he can kick you, he can spit on you, he can... But you stand by him, honey. You light up my life. I'm a piece of dung without you, baby. That's what those songs are saying. They're saying, I can't live without you. That's straight codependency. I can't live without you is straight codependency. You have no inner life. You have no life of your own. So what happens, codependents get in relationships, the relationships end. Then they think, I can't live, I've got to find somebody else. We've got to learn that the goal of life is to move from environmental support to self-support. That healthy people support themselves from within. Codependents depend on the outside for all their happiness. Healthy people generate their happiness from the inside. Generate their own good feelings from the inside, not from the outside. My happiness is not dependent on my wife or my children. It's depending on my own inner self. Do you see the problem? So codependency isn't something new. Shakespeare was writing about it. The love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, T.S. Eliot's great poem. You know, Prufrock. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker and watched the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker, and in short I was afraid I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. When I am pinned and wiggling on the wall, I've seen my head brought in like John the Baptist. See, he's always fantasizing, but he's always afraid, and he hides in this little kind of behind this facade, and he has no inner life. God, T.S. Eliot was writing a poem for a whole generation of the 20s. He quoted from the spirit of Guido and Dante's Inferno at the beginning of that poem. If I thought anybody could hear me, I would not answer you. I'm in hiding. Okay. So what I'd like to do with you, if you're beginning to identify with any of this, about 10 people came up to me last night and said, good God, it's like you just beat me up. And that isn't my purpose, to run around beating people up. But my purpose is to know how deep the delusion and the denial is and how easy it is to sweep the stuff that's painful under the rug. And I'm not into pain, believe me. Believe me, I'm not into pain. In fact, I'm almost addicted to whatever feels good. But what I know is no pain, no gain. Buddha's first noble truth is that life is suffering. The Jews had to go through bondage in Egypt. They had to cross the Red Sea. They had to journey in the desert to get to the promised land. Jesus says there's no resurrection without crucifixion. The spiritual masters all talk about the training, the discipline, the going into the desert, the symbol of the desert. In order to get to life. So it's terribly important that we get it that this is a part and parcel of life. There are places in the heart, Leon Blois says, that do not yet exist. Pain must be in order that they be. There are places in the heart that do not yet exist. Pain must be in order that they be. Gibran, the deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain, is not the cup that holds your wine, the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven, is not the lute that plays your music, the very lute that was whittled with knives. What a strange thing is pleasure and pain, that you can't have one without the other, that you can't have one without the other. Without a hurt, a heart is hollow. When the day has been too weary and the night has been too long and you think that love is only for the lucky and the strong, just remember in the winter, far beneath the bitter snow, lies a seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes a rose. Albert Camus, in the midst of winter, I found within me an invincible summer. See, that pain will drive us back. It will bring us to what's great in us, to ourselves. But if we avoid the pain, you know, somebody said the job of therapy is to take you out of your misery into your pain. What a cruddy job. Okay. Now, in order to really get this stuff and break through my delusion and denial, what I believe is that people really, lots of us, are going to have to get to the feelings about it. And what I've given you in these notes, just disregard the first page, because that's something I'm going to talk about this afternoon. But if you look at the first page, it says a first step worksheet. Now, what I was told when I went into my 12-step program is that you've got to believe that you're powerless and your life's unmanageable, or you're not going to do anything about it. That until I believe that I'm powerless and that something's unmanageable, I'm not going to do anything about it. And so one of the values, see, a lot of you can say, God, I identify with what Bradshaw was talking about up there. Boy, that my family was like this, and my dad was a rageaholic, and yes, I have trouble with my feelings, and I hyperventilate, and I'm hypervigilant, and I'm afraid of authority, and I've married addicts, but you're still not doing anything. If I say, are you in a program? What are you doing about it? You say, well, I haven't quite done anything about it yet. See, you're still in delusion and denial. And, not my job to, pontificate and try to make anybody get into their recovery program, but I can only share with you that I was 11 years in my own sobriety before I got onto any of this. Bobby Earle's sharing, he was years and years in sobriety and still feeling suicidal, and many of us are telling the story that we hadn't dealt with the codependency. We hadn't dealt with the codependency issues. Now the major thing I deal with are the codependency issues. And I am doing recovery for codependency. And I want to recommend it to you. And one of the things that I want to recommend is that you write out a first step. That is, if you've gotten connected with a lot of the things I was talking about last night or this morning, then I'm going to show you how to do a first step. And the goal of this step is to get you into the feelings about it so that you can feel, and that the next time there's a tendency to be nice in a relationship and rescue somebody and do a bunch of things that you don't want to do, you will have experienced the pain that that behavior is costing you and the life-damaging consequences of it so that you will not do it. I'm almost 22 years sober. The thought of a drink never occurs to me. I mean, you could all be smoking dope right now, and it could be surrounding me, and I will not do it. The pain of that stuff is so great, and the memory of that pain is still so great. I can see myself in R&I Ward 8 in Austin State Hospital right this minute. I can see myself laying in a room with eight other people in a room about the size of a corner over here, with people going into electroconvulsive therapy, and me walking to the dining room with another alcohol addict back to back so they didn't knife us because they hate alcoholics. They don't think we're sick enough in state hospitals. I'll never forget this. I, who was going to be a priest, who was going to Europe to study with Karl Rahner, who was the first of the first in honor philosophy. What am I doing in a state house? I'll never forget that. You couldn't do anything to get me to take it. The pain, the emotion. Now, you got to get emotion about your codependency, because that's what will fuel you and move you to work on it. And that's what writing does. When you write it, there's neurological data about what happens when we write stuff. There's neurological data that supports that writing is much better than just talking about it. So, when I say this worksheet should be written out, the example should be specific and should include feelings. Unless you have your feelings for how destructive your chemical use is. Now, we use this in our center, and our center focuses a lot on chemical addiction, but you don't just supply the word, your codependency. How destructive your codependency has been, you'll have little reason for continuing a recovery program if you don't feel it. The next time the urge to use or the urge to act out codependently You'll easily be able to erase the memory, but you will not easily be able to erase the feelings. Okay? Now, turn over to the next page. That's the rationale. That is the rationale for writing it out. Now, we don't have time this morning for you to write it all out. What I'm encouraging you to do is I want to take you through it, and then I'm going to encourage you to do this for yourself. Love yourself enough. Care about yourself enough to go ahead and do this. And if you're a person that comes from a reasonably functional family, you're one of those few percentages, this can still be valuable as an inventory to kind of catch up with yourself. What I've done in this inventory is I've taken the letters of the word codependence. And on the left-hand side of the page, I've written a trait of codependency. And the first step in 12-step program says we were powerless and our life is unmanageable. See, what all of us try to do is control this stuff. I quit drinking every Lent for years. I've been on 5,000 diets. I have lost 5,000 pounds. We know that 2% of diets work, that fat is a family affair, and so is bulimia and anorexia and the fat thin disorder, which I carry, which is the obsessing on food. You either obsessing about not eating, and then I go eat a donut, and then I eat a donut, and I say, well, I eat a donut. What the heck? And I eat 10 donuts. Or I eat Bluebell cookies and cream ice cream till I can't feel my mouth. And then I start putting on weight, and then I obsess on the weight, and then I go into my running program and my nutritional program and no sugar, and I do that for a while. See, control, and that's just another side of shame. Control is one of the ways not to deal with your shame. You've got to surrender. The only way out of this stuff is to surrender. I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. Take me! I need help. That is the only way out of this stuff. You can't control it. You can't say, well, I think I'll control my codependency tomorrow. Not without a group, not without consciousness raising, not without staying on top of it, because the second you get away from this stuff, you go right back into the dysfunctional roles. Now, forever? Do you have to do it forever? Maybe not. I think I will, and I'm okay with that. But maybe you don't, but you have to do it for a while. And I recommend that you have some kind of group that you're in where people are dealing with these issues that you can talk about it. I recommend the Adult Children of Alcoholics, the codependency groups, the Al-Anon groups, for dealing with codependent type issues.